Coming up on this week's book show, Alice Hoffman's latest novel is a bittersweet parable about the costs of survival and the behaviors that define humanity. The World That We Knew is set in Berlin in 1941. It follows the lives of three women who become intertwined in order to survive the dangers of the Nazi regime. Alice Hoffman on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Alice Hoffman's new novel, The World That We Knew, is set in Berlin in 1941. It follows the lives of three women who become intertwined in order to survive the dangers of the Nazi regime. Leah is a 12-year-old girl who has been sent away from her family for protection. Eddie, a rabbi's daughter, creates a mythical Jewish creature, a unique female golem named Eva, to protect Leah. Together, the three women use their strength to avoid persecution. Hoffman's latest book is a bittersweet parable about the costs of survival and the behaviors that define humanity. She is the author of more than 30 works of fiction. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with the Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, and recorded before a live audience. It's a pleasure to welcome Alice Hoffman to this week's Book Show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much.
I want to get into the origin story of it. But before we do that, let me ask this question, which is, would you have written this book 10 years ago? Which is another way of saying where we are right now in the world, this book seems to be very much a product of its time. Is that safe to say?
I think so, because in 2016, I was actually writing, I had just begun a book about New York real estate, and I immediately stopped writing that and started writing The World That We Knew. But The World That We Knew was a book that I had been carrying with me for some time, because I had met this woman after a reading that I gave in Florida, and she really was the reason that I wrote the book, and I think it may have been 15 years earlier. But this seemed now like the right time to write it. But as I was writing it, you know, sometimes it seems like life imitates art. Yeah. And as I was writing it, the world started to follow along with what I was writing. It was a very strange experience.
Did it help you understand what you were writing about, of what was happening in the world?
You know, I think I wrote this book because I needed hope, because I needed to find some kind of light in the darkness. And I always feel that I write a book because I have a question that I need to have answered. And for me, the question is, you know, how do people survive in dark times? And I decided, and this is something I never do, because I usually don't talk to people about a book that I'm working on. I decided I wanted to meet survivors. And that's what I did.
Holocaust survivors.
Yes.
You went first local and then went to France,
yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah.
What was that experience like in meeting with, and yeah. I am, before you answer that, how far into the process were you when you wanted to meet with them?
I think I had written just a little bit about the book. I had qualms about writing the book because I felt like, you know, I didn't know that it was if it was my story to tell. And so that's why I think I wanted to talk to survivors who were children at the time and now are in their 80s and 90s.
In the author's note, you talk about this, of a woman coming up to you and saying that she wanted you to tell this story.
Yeah.
And you said, well, I don't do that.
Right.
Which seems like a fair answer. I think you were in a parking lot, right?
Yeah, we were in a parking lot outside of a library in Palm Beach.
Okay, well.
And she was waiting for me.
Yeah, call security. So, but it seems that, right, so you do the nice thing, and then, but it stays with you.
She really stayed with me because she said to me, if you don't tell my story, and I had never heard about children in France that were separated from their parents and put into these chateaus, these children's schools. Because at first, the Jews that were deported were over the age of 16, and so there were all these children left alone, and also children being sent from Germany to France. She said, if you don't tell this story, people are going to forget it. It's going to disappear.
Did you find that to be a common theme of the survivors that you talked to, that they were worried that their stories would disappear?
I did find that to be a common theme. And the funny thing is, for several of them, they hadn't told their stories for many, many years, and were suddenly telling their stories. In fact, one woman that I met had just written a book about her experience, but had never really talked to her son about what had happened. I mean, it's so traumatic, it's hard to talk about, but I think there is the feeling that you want people to remember, especially because these things happen again and again. And, you know, I'm not equating to anything that's happening now to the Holocaust, but it's about hatred and how hatred can grow. Can start out really small and get bigger and bigger before you know it.
You were looking for hope.
Yeah.
Does writing allow you that, in the sense of that search for hope, looking, of knowing where the rocks are to look under, to find it?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, you know, I was going to write about the Holocaust. I knew this. And I knew I would find terrible, evil things. Right. And in fact, many, many years ago when I was a screenwriter, I was asked to write Schindler's List before Steven Spielberg was involved, and I just thought, I can't tell that. That's not my story to tell. It's too dark. But I found something that I didn't expect, which is I found so many good people and so many amazing stories about people who were willing to act heroically and who were willing to be upstanders, not bystanders. That's what I was looking for. That was really my quest.
So you're doing these conversations. They're not interviews, right? They're conversations.
They're conversations. Yeah.
And they're telling you their story.
Yeah.
And you're not taking that directly, but I assume it puts you in a frame of mind.
That's exactly what it is. I didn't want the details of their life specifically. I wanted to know the emotions of what it felt like. And in fact, when I was in France, there was a gentleman who came from Paris. Mm. He was, I think, 90. And we went to the village where he had been as a child. He hadn't been back since he was a child. We went together, and it was extremely emotional. We were looking for the house that he was hidden in, and we couldn't find it. But just to be there with him was so emotional, and to see kind of what he was going through, kind of remembering being there. That's really what I wanted to know and get to by meeting people.
Does it make the writing of the book more emotional than the writing of another book?
For me, it was very emotional. I mean, I think I write emotional stories. I think I write from a subconscious state. But having met these people, having been in all of these places, all of these schools, having dinner at a table with a woman in close to 90 who was crying about losing her father on the last train to Auschwitz, it definitely intensified it for me. And I wanted to find that light.
Does the woman that you met in the parking lot know you wrote this book?
I don't know. I don't know because we talked so briefly. I don't know her name. I don't know. I really don't know anything about her. But she just stayed with me. And sometimes when I think about it, I think maybe she was an angel waiting for me in the parking lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that seems like the loveliest thing of all, of looking back on that experience and remembering it that way.
Yeah. I feel like I was given this story. And that I was very fortunate to be given this story because it took me on an incredible journey that I felt like kind of saved myself. You know, I felt like I needed to know that there was goodness in the world and that people survived.
One of the things I find interesting is that you have a mystical world and it's a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And those are the oldest and best stories, right?
I totally agree. I think there are the original stories, the stories that grandmothers told to grandchildren, the oral tradition of telling these cautionary tales that have a big moral implication for children.
So how do you then, for want of a better term, balance that with the reality of the Holocaust and of the war itself?
Well, I think it was kind of easy because what happened during the Holocaust was so not rational, so illogical, it made no sense. So to write about it in a realistic way was not something I felt like I could even do. I couldn't explain how people acted this way. I could only explain it in terms of fairy tale logic, that sometimes human beings acted like beasts and beasts acted very humanely. And that's what I used. I mean, I grew up with fairy tales, so the first literature in my life. And so for me to see it in those terms was very easy.
What were the fairy tales that you grew up with?
Well, mostly the Grimm's fairy tales, but also a lot of Russian fairy tales.
Well, they are grim.
They are grim. But you know, the thing about fairy tales is something like 85% of the heroines are girls and women, which is not true in most stories. And a lot of it is about rescuing yourself. I feel like for me, that was very important to hear. And then I also had a Russian grandmother, and so there were all the stories that she told me. We would be sitting on a bus going in, you know, on Broadway in New York City, and she would be telling me about living in Russia and how the river would freeze all year long. And I just felt like she came from a fairy tale world.
Did those conversations, I assume they informed this as well?
They did.
The story is very different, but what was her input to you that you would think of as you were writing?
Well, I have one piece, which maybe I'll read a little bit of, that I didn't even... I think the writer's usually the last to know what the book's about. I think readers are much smarter about what the book is really about. And I always think that with a novel, there's an outside story and there's an inside story. And the outside story is the plot and the characters, but the inside story is kind of the psychology and the emotional content. And I think very often as a writer, you don't know what it is until you finish. And then sometimes you read it and you think, oh, that's what I was writing about.
And we don't need to know that.
No, not at all. I don't even need to know it. Maybe my therapist needs to know it. But
yeah,
no, you don't, because, you know, a book becomes yours when you're a reader. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about a book, is that it doesn't really matter what the symbolism means to me or to the writer. It matters what it means to you.
I'd love for you to read a little bit.
Okay. I will read a little part. And this is a part that I really didn't understand was so influenced by my Russian grandmother, but it's about a Russian grandmother. To say goodbye is a terrible thing, made even worse when you don't know why you're being sent away. We can't give up, Bobesh, she said, as she hugged Leah. We have to save the next generation so that one day you can rescue people, as your father did. Their embrace lasted a long time, long enough for Bobashi to tell Leah the story of the last wolf in her village. It was the middle of winter, when the whole world was white, and a wolf and her cub had been chased as far as they could go. There was no escape, at least not for both. When the mother wolf ran to attack the hunters, all they saw were her claws and her fangs. While they shot her, the cub disappeared into the snow. That was the moment when its coat turned from black to white, so that it was forever after invisible to hunters. That is the way a mother triumphs, Bobesche said. All you have to do is survive, and your mother lives through you. Leah kissed her mother, nothing more. She did none of the things that she wanted to do. She did not lock herself in the closet or throw her suitcase across the room. I will always love you, her mother told her, wherever you are. Leah knew this was true, but Bobeshi had told her a harder truth. The wolf had turned white in the snow. It had managed to live, but it went on alone.
Alice Hoffman reading from The World That We Knew. The new novel is out from Simon & Schuster. I was struck when you were talking a moment ago about talking to survivors and this book being about survival. It seems to me that most of your books are about survival.
I did start to realize that after a while. That, you know, I think writers do have themes, and I think my themes are about love and loss and survival.
But that survival part is really key to it, isn't
it? It's key to it. For me, in many different ways. I mean, for one thing, I'm a breast cancer survivor of 20 years, so I think that has influenced me more. But I think even before that, that's what I was interested in, is how people survived, how they survived trauma, how they survived darkness and terrible things and loss, and how they managed to go on.
What's fascinating about that is as you're living through it, you don't know that you can.
Exactly, yeah.
is that a question that, again, you said you had a question at the beginning that you wanted to answer. So is that something in a broader sense that this idea of survival is something that you were interested in playing with and exploring
very
as you
much
go through
so.
Your writing life?
Yeah, very much so. I feel like, you know, I saw Toni Morrison in the last year of her life give 3 lectures. I think she's the greatest
Amazing.
American writer ever.
Absolutely.
And she said that she always started with a question. It made me feel much better and much smarter. I always feel like there is a question. I mean, it is about survival and love and loss, but there's usually a specific question that I don't know the answer to that I need to find out.
I think the last time we talked, you said something that stuck with me, that the only time that you ever had writer's block was after 9/11.
That's right, yeah.
You got over that through reading Ray Bradbury.
Yeah. Ray Bradbury's been just a huge, important force in my life. And I mean, I think what you read when you're 12 or 13 influences you more than anything else. And that's when I read him. And I think every 12 and 13-year-old should be reading Ray Bradbury.
And yet in some schools, it's still a banned book.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Well, because, I don't understand
because,
any of that,
you know, Fahrenheit 451, which is the, you know, I felt like I couldn't write after 9/11 because I felt like, what's the point of writing?
Right.
Everything's going to be set on fire. Everything's burning. What difference does it make? And luckily, my subconscious told me to read Fahrenheit 451. And that book is all about how important books are and how important literature is, and that it seems so dangerous that firemen are burning books, and that people love literature so much that they become the book. And they memorize the book so that the book can never die. And, you know, after that, I wrote a book for teens called Green Angel,
yeah,
which was about a girl who'd been traumatized who wrote her way back to life. And in a way, I feel like that's been my whole life. I've written my way back to life. But Ray Bradbury was a huge force, and I got to know him a little bit before his death. And next year, I think it's going to be the anniversary of his 100th birthday. And I feel like for me, I don't even know. Sometimes, you know, writers are just so important to you. And it really, I always heard, you know, the writer isn't the person you meet, it's the person you read. But with Ray, it was both. You know, he was so fantastic, both as a person and as a writer.
So, so smart.
Yeah.
I had the great fortune of interviewing him twice.
Oh, wow.
And just such a beautiful conversation. I know he had answered the questions that I had come up with probably 4,000 times, but my God, he was just so thoughtful. Fascinating.
Yeah, he was an amazing, amazing person. And really a moral force. You know, in his world, there is good and evil. And you have to learn to tell the difference to get through your life, to survive your life.
What happens when we see good and evil differently? Your good is my evil is your good.
That's a question I haven't answered yet. I mean, I think that's a problem, and that's a problem right now. But I am not so convinced that somebody acting in a way that's evil considers themselves to be acting in a way that's good. I mean, I think there's differences in opinion, but I think when true evil does not see itself as good, it's filled with hate, and it's not about good and evil for that person. It's about getting what they want.
And at any cost.
At any cost. And that people are no longer people. They're just other. You know, they're refugees, they're Jews, they're foreigners, they're just other. They're not as important. They just don't matter.
I'm hoping you can read just a little bit more about the grandmother and the wolf.
Yeah. This is a part where Leah, the young girl, has run away with this mythical being, Ava. They were so well hidden that Ava allowed Leah the freedom to wander. She was going for water from a nearby stream when she saw a wolf, just as Bobashi had when she was a girl, not much older than Leah was now. At first, Leah thought it was a dream that she had never woken from, but she reached down and she pinched herself, and the pinch stung, and she knew she was awake. And then she was certain that what had happened to Bobeshi was now happening to her. The wolf was black with yellow eyes. It was said such creatures had been hunted to extinction in this region. They had been shot by royal hunting parties, but some things cannot be destroyed so easily. Leah lifted her eyes to look into his. He had been so quiet she hadn't heard him approach. She had to stay alive. She had made a promise. but how to do so was the question. Don't run, her grandmother had told her. Do not be afraid. Be who you are and know that he will be who he is. How many wolves were left? 3 or 4? Half a dozen? Or was it just this single wolf watching her from the edge of the stream, ready to leap if she was the sort of human who had a gun or a knife or an eye for murder? Soon enough, he saw that she was just a girl sitting by the stream, and they were themselves, and they knew each other, and they could feel one another's loneliness. When you are a wolf, no place is safe. No one can be trusted unless they are what you are, hunted. We were wolves in the forest, chased until there was nowhere to go. When you are not considered human, you learn how to run. He was bigger than a dog and ragged, and Leah was motionless. And when he came close, his breath was warm, and he smelled of grass. He was not young, and he was weary, for he had seen enough of men to last him a lifetime.
Alice Hoffman reading from The World That We Knew. The idea of the novel coming from that story of the hidden children, how did you then decide to set it up the way that you did, giving us that backstory of this is why Eddie was sent away and how?
Well, you know, I don't know if I really decided it or if it just kind of happened. I think what happens for me is I create the world. I learn as much as I can about the world. And then the characters step into that world and they start to act and they start to do things. I mean, sometimes I have to kind of revise what they're doing, but basically they start to do things and become alive.
Is the creation of the world the fun part?
Yeah, it really is. It's the part when I use colored magic markers.
Oh, yes. Now, so what?
So it's got to be fun.
Okay, so how does that, is it visual or is it?
It's visual for me because I want to know everything about the world. I mean, usually I start a book knowing nothing.
Yeah.
So I want to know every plant that grows and what the birds are like and what the rivers are and what the cities are like and what, you know, and what people wore, what kind of clothing they wore, what the shoes were like. So I start to build the world in that way. And in that way, I feel sometimes I'm kind of like the set designer. You know, I set the stage and then something happens. Something magically happens and the characters are alive or not, depending on the case.
So it tells me that you have a certain confidence in doing this because you're using magic marker as opposed to like colored pencil.
Yeah. Well, you can cross out.
Unless it's dry erase board, and that's a completely different thing. But you can still mold it. But in setting it up, I mean, I assume you have a confidence now as a writer that, okay,
I start every novel thinking I don't know how to write a novel. I don't know how I did this. I don't even know who that person was who wrote those books, and I have to learn all over again.
Well,
sorry.
No, I understand that. But what does that tell us about you? Do you think?
I think it's brand new every time, and I think that's why I stay interested in doing it.
Well, you want it to be brand new every time. Well, your books are also different. I mean, that's what's lovely about them. I mean, in that sense, I understand that. But you have to have a personal... I mean, I wouldn't be... If I was so... if I felt that I was so... that I had to learn every time that I did an interview, that I had to learn every skill to do that again, I wouldn't agree to do anymore. I mean, you're signing a contract. So I assume, like, you figure, well, I can figure this out.
Well, I feel like whether I can figure it out or not, it's something I have to do. It's something I want to do, and it's something I have to do.
You have to write.
If it doesn't go right, then it doesn't. But I have to do it. I don't have a choice.
And like most authors, I assume you've gotten a third or halfway through a novel and say, yeah, okay, this is done.
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of a sad thing. But I always think, you know, sometimes I'll use pieces from
sure.
those discarded. But sometimes it's just like part of the process to go through that gets you to the next book in some way.
I have a lot of interviews that will never air. And I just think of them as practice. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think of it as practice. I always think of it, I also knit. I think of it as, you know, when you knit, you can knit for a long time and then have to take the whole thing apart. And that I think that's true of writing a book, too. Sometimes you have to take the whole thing apart and put it back together again.
But again, back to the joy of creating the world. I mean, that's the joy that you have in it of wanting to do it again.
Yeah, for me, this is horrible to say, but for me, it's kind of like a drug. I mean, it's an out-of-body experience.
I don't think that's horrible.
Well,
I mean that sounds about right. I mean, you want to feel that way of doing it.
Yeah,
it's not illegal. It's fine.
Good. It's not illegal yet.
Fair point. The idea of the worlds that you have created, do you see a crossover in those worlds?
I do. And I'm starting to see it more and more, where there are certain issues and certain themes and certain symbols that are coming forward more and more. And I'm starting to see my work as kind of a whole, rather. I mean, the books are all very different, but there's something that links them all together.
Let's go back to the woman in the parking lot in Palm Beach.
Sure.
You resonated with her in a way that she wanted you to tell her story. I mean, that tells you the power of writing, the power that Ray Bradbury had for you, the power that writers have for all of us.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very strong power.
Well, I feel like it's back to kind of the original storytelling of the grandmother telling the story to the granddaughter. And I felt, that's what I felt like happened in that parking lot, is that she was like my grandmother and she wanted me to continue the story. And it took me a long time, but I finally did it.
The two sections, beautiful sections that you read for us, were you thinking of your grandmother as you were writing them, or did that come later?
I was, and I didn't even realize that as I wrote the book, because one of the stories she had told me was that every morning, because she was the oldest child, she had to go to the river to chop ice for water, and she was terrified of the wolves that were down there. And she had to kind of come to terms with the fact that they weren't that different than she was. And she lost her fear of the wolves. And I think, you know, that definitely was behind the story that I was telling.
The relationship that you had with her and that storytelling, it seems then that goes back to and talking to the survivors that you're there again talking to your grandparents.
That's exactly how I felt. I felt when I was talking to the survivors, I was talking to my grandparents. And that made me feel like I had the right to tell the story and that I should tell the story.
And that it was your story to tell.
Yeah, then it felt that way.
And that must, not to overuse the word, but that is a power too.
It is. I mean, I think reading is very powerful. I mean, I think, you know, it's so interactive. It's so personal. It's so amazing that you get a book and there's marks on paper, and then in your head you create a world. You as the reader create the world.
I first came to your work. My mother, who was a librarian, loved your books so much.
Thank you.
She passed away a number of years ago, but she loved your books. And so now to be sharing with you and talking to you about reading and writing and family and love and loss, it's very, very special. And I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really love talking to you.
Great pleasure.
Thank you.
Alice Hoffman's new novel is The World That We Knew. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Saratoga Springs, New York, in partnership with the Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.